The Takeaway needs your help. Please visit WNYCpodcastingsurvey.com and tell us a little bit about you and the podcast you love in a 5-minute anonymous survey. We really, really appreciate your help. Knowing more about you helps us make more of the shows that you enjoy. Thank you from all of us at The Takeaway. And now, this is The Takeaway for Thursday, April 20th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. As always, we thank you so much for being with us today. And we begin this hour not with the business of governing, as we so often do, but rather being in business while governing. The Trump name, securing the titles and responsibilities of the presidency, and selling big worldwide. It's true for the commander-in-chief, and it's also true for his daughter and advisor, Ivanka. Now, there are policy disputes and pleas that Ms. Trump helped to change her father's mind on some issues. Ivanka Trump is an official advisor. She has a West Wing office, and she takes high-level meetings with foreign leaders. At the same time, Ivanka Trump's international apparel brand that she launched in 2007 and carries her name is selling more than ever. It's raised questions about what happens when high government officials have conflicts of interest, ones that inevitably mix their personal business with the people's business.
I don't know that the critics who may say that of me, if they found themselves in this very unique and unprecedented situation that I am now in, would do any differently than I'm doing. And I felt like proximity to my father and to the White House, and with my husband taking such an influential role in the administration, I didn't want to also be running a business.
Ivanka Trump says she isn't involved in her company's day-to-day decisions, but business is booming. U.S. imports of Ivanka Trump's brand are up an estimated 166% since last year. Mostly those imports come from China. Meanwhile, the Trump business has been gaining key access to Chinese markets while Ivanka Trump meets officially with Chinese leaders. In just a minute, we're going to parse the ongoing ethical quandaries embedded in these relationships. But first, we go to Shanghai. Erica Kienitz is a reporter for the Associated Press in Shanghai, and she joins me to talk about the first daughter's business dealings there. Erica, welcome.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Erica, how big is Ivanka Trump's business in China right now, and how has it grown since her father took the oath of office on January 20th?
Well, I think it's safe to say that politics has not stopped the commercial engine of Ivanka's business. She doesn't have a large retail presence in China, but she certainly has a big lifestyle brand that is sold in the United States and around the world. We looked at her company, which has announced new product lines since the election and has sought to expand its intellectual property footprint all around the world, taking out new trademark applications in Puerto Rico and the Philippines and Canada, as well as winning new trademark approvals provisionally from the government of China since the inauguration. Sales have also been doing quite well for her company.
So the trademarks and intellectual property permissions that the company's been pursuing all over the world, how important are they? What are they worth to a business like Ivanka Trump's?
Well, intellectual property is the basis for a business like Ivanka Trump's. Her company is built on licensing deals, and you can't sell the right to somebody to use your name unless you have the legal right to your name in a particular country. So trademarks can be enormously valuable things.
And those trademarks require, of course, the permission of the host government in whatever country you want to sell in.
Well, that's right. Trademarks are granted by the government, and that's why they create some ethical issues for federal officials. Because under the U.S. Constitution, federal officials aren't allowed to accept anything of value from foreign governments, and that law applies to Ivanka.
Ivanka Trump's lawyer says that she's recusing herself from specific issues related to day-to-day decisions on clothing and merchandise imports from China and other countries, but not on broader policy issues.
That's right. I think they're taking a fairly narrow interpretation of conflict of interest laws. So as a federal employee, Ivanka is subject to potentially criminal penalties for violating conflict of interest laws, which say that you as a federal employee can't weigh in on any decision-making or policy that could have a financial impact on you or your spouse. So anything related to Ivanka's business would block both her and her husband, Jared Kushner, who's a senior presidential advisor, from participating in those discussions. What her lawyer has said is that Ivanka will steer clear of specific policy areas like, say, tariffs on clothing from China, because Ivanka's clothing is predominantly made in China, but that she wouldn't step back from broad swaths of policy like overall trade with China or foreign policy, so that she and Jared, under their interpretation of the law, would still have an ability to be prominent interlocutors with China for the administration.
And is it clear when you look at the growth of Ivanka Trump's business in China or the growth of her business in the United States based on Chinese imports, just how much those business interests are actually intertwined with her day-to-day job as a White House advisor? Is that easy to tell from the outside?
Well, that's a good question. It's not easy to tell from the outside. For one thing, her company is privately held, so they're under no obligations to disclose their earnings or even their corporate structure, which is pretty complicated from what information we have. So what we can do is look at third-party data, and we did that. We looked at imports from China. We looked at online sales. We looked at the sales data that one of her key suppliers reported to the SEC, and all those indicators pointed up. In some cases, very, very strongly up. So there was interesting data from a big online e-commerce fashion platform called List, which showed that some of the spikes in her sales online were directly correlated with political developments, like her father's election back in November, or even more strongly with Kellyanne Conway's comments in early February to go buy Ivanka's merchandise.
Who's been a champion for women empowerment,
sure.
Women in the workplace, to get to him.
Just,
so I think people can see through that.
30
go
seconds.
Go buy Ivanka's stuff is what I would tell. I hate shopping. I'm going to go get some on myself today.
So there is market evidence that statement by Kellyanne Conway on television that earned her a rebuke from the government ethics office, in fact, did help spike sales of Ivanka clothing and apparel here in the United States.
According to List's data, yes. We don't have data from, for example, physical retailers, what happened at Macy's and Nordstrom's and all of these shops. But we do have that online data, and that was very clear. It showed a tremendous spike. On the day that Kellyanne Conway spoke, sales were up for the month of February 2017, like 771% over February 2016.
Erica Kienitz is a reporter in Shanghai for the Associated Press, reporting on the business interests of presidential advisor and first daughter Ivanka Trump. Erica, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Joining us now to continue our ongoing conversation of ethics in the Trump administration is Norm Eisen. He's former White House ethics czar from 2009 until 2011. He's also chair of the government watchdog group CRU, that's Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. CRU has its own lawsuit against President Trump, alleging violations of the Constitution's Emoluments Clause, and we'll talk about developments in that case as well. Norm Eisen, welcome.
Thank you, Todd. Nice to be here again.
Well, you just heard Erica Kienitz describing the growth of Ivanka Trump's business, not only here in the United States, but also overseas. What does that growth of her business, let's say particularly in China, while she's a key White House advisor, say to you?
It says to me that Ivanka Trump, like the entire Trump family, most of all her dad, has an extraordinary conflict of interest because she's involved in important decisions, including those that may bear upon China, and she stands to gain enormously from these valuable Chinese trademarks, and the same is true in other countries. It's very troubling.
Now, Ivanka Trump herself and through her lawyer say that she's taken steps to reduce conflict of interest or the appearance of it. Are these steps any good? She says she's not participating in any business decisions at her company. But at the same time, as we've said with her father in so many decisions, she can't unknow what her business interests are around the world when she's sitting in the Oval Office making decisions.
The steps that Ivanka has taken are positive ones, but they're not enough, Todd. First of all, again, like her father, she's not giving up the ownership interest in her business. So she's keeping the financial stake and stands to personally benefit from trademark awards and other business cash and benefits around the world. Number two, the problem is that the bare minimum that the law requires is not going to cut it here. Ivanka has an enormous conflict, not just when it comes to China, but elsewhere around the world in places where she is seeking trademarks broadly, globally, where she has business interests. She's going to need to take a further step back. When I was applying these laws in the Obama White House, and the same is true of my Bush era predecessor, we never would have allowed this. So much more needs to be done.
Does the law apply to Ivanka Trump in the same way that it applies to her father? He is fond of saying that the law can't really touch him here, so that any adjustments he's making are sort of out of the goodness of his own decisions. Is the law the same for her?
That's a false statement by Donald Trump, like so much else that comes out of his mouth. Our founders and framers were so concerned about this that they put a limit in the Constitution on government officials accepting cash and benefits from foreign governments. So Donald Trump is bound by the Constitution. No one is above the law in the United States. Even more rules apply to lower officials like Ivanka Trump. So she's not only got serious questions that we're going to need to evaluate under the Constitution, but federal ethics laws fully apply to her, and she's got to do more.
While we have you here, I do want to get an update on your organization's lawsuit against the president challenging testing the emoluments clause in the Constitution that you mentioned. That case involves the Trump International Hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue, but you've recently expanded it.
We have. The case is, I'm proud to say, accelerating, Todd. We've added this week, we've amended the complaint to add the Restaurant Opportunity Center, a consortium of hundreds of restaurants and thousands of restaurant workers that compete with the Donald Trump enterprises. And we've added as well a hotel competitor. So the case, we believed, was strong when we started, when my watchdog group crew was the plaintiff. We believe we had good standing to raise these issues. But many people said, well, it would be even better if you had competitors to come in. You have what we call in law competitor standing. That's unimpeachable. Now we have that. And we've also added other claims, including this absurd conduct with respect to the old post office, where Donald Trump is now on both sides of the lease benefiting from that. That's against the law. And we've added a set of what we call domestic emoluments claims. He's not only violating the rule against foreign government gifts, cash benefits, he's also violating another concern the founders put in the Constitution, which is state governments are not allowed to provide cash and benefits to Donald Trump, and the federal government is not allowed to do it, and yet he's raking those in. So the case is accelerating, picking up speed, and we're proud to be among those who are defending our Constitution.
Norm Eisen was the ethics czar in the White House under President Obama from 2009 to 2011. He's also co-chair of the government watchdog group CREW, which is currently involved in an emoluments lawsuit against President Trump. Norm Eisen, thanks as always.
Thank you, Todd. My pleasure.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. People flock to Florida for the sun and the beach and for Disney World, of course. But the state has established itself as a mecca for other reasons, too. There's a booming drug rehab and recovery industry in South Florida. It draws thousands of people a year to treatment centers all over. But that industry has put a strain on local communities now, as the opioid crisis drives more people to seek treatment. In the course of one night in Delray, Florida, police are likely to receive multiple calls for overdoses from sober living facilities. WLRN reporter Peter Hayden has been investigating the overdose crisis in South Florida. He rode on patrol one night with Ed McCabe, a sergeant of the Delray Beach Police Department, to find out more about the community's treatment reputation and its impact on the town.
Delray Beach is at the epicenter of a South Florida overdose epidemic. It's estimated to have claimed more than 1,000 lives last year. Medical examiners are still counting.
29, clear 2.
Sergeant McCabe's a cop's cop, 36, about 6 feet tall, athletic, grew up in New Jersey in a family of cops. He's been working these same neighborhoods in Delray since he joined the force 15 years ago. Sergeant McCabe says about 5 years back, Delray started to change.
But yeah, the overdoses, they're like a dime a dozen, so I think it's just, you hate to say it, but it's more routine nowadays than anything else.
Three things came together to create this South Florida overdose crisis. About 10 years ago, South Florida developed the dubious distinction of being the pill mill capital of the U.S.
It was like a revolving door. You're watching zombies coming in and out of the city from all over. Guys coming down from Kentucky with fake prescriptions and fake x-rays, showing a doctor, getting prescribed like 300 pills within an hour or so. They'd run out of them. It was that crazy.
In 2011, state and federal agencies cracked down on the South Florida pill mills.
Shady doctors.
But by then, lots of locals were hooked on the drugs. So they turned to something cheaper, easier to find, and totally unpredictable. Street heroin.
62 years I've been living here, but I ain't never seen heroin this bad, man.
Rudolph Wims has also seen the change. He's standing outside a dimly lit corner store in central Delray Beach.
Only time I seen it was in the 70s, but it wasn't killing nobody. It's just sad, man.
Back on patrol, McCabe slows down as we pass a brick duplex.
Overdose there last week. The guy was there, just moved in. He was there for about 4 hours.
This brings us to the second factor. That guy just arrived in Delray from out of state.
For decades, South Florida has been this absolute mecca for people in recovery. People would come from all over the world to receive treatment services here.
Andrew Berkey runs Life of Purpose, a treatment center on the Florida Atlantic University campus in Boca Raton. Starting in the 1970s, treatment centers in Palm Beach County began offering a sun-soaked solution to kick addiction. People came, got clean, and stayed.
One, it's a very, very geographically nice location, the same reason people retire down here. I mean, it's, hashtag subtropical paradise. But then, I mean, there's also just a lot of talented clinicians and a huge community that built up down here.
In Palm Beach County, addiction recovery is a $1 billion a year industry, according to an analysis by the Palm Beach Post.
And so you have this large, you know, hundreds of thousands of people that are in recovery that are supportive of new people coming in recovery, which is what made South Florida vulnerable to be preyed upon.
Patients and insurance companies. Corrupt operators figured out they could make millions by billing for expensive, unnecessary tests. And when a patient's insurance benefits are tapped out, a relapse will start those benefits all over again, which means there's more money to be made when patients fall off the wagon than when they stay sober. Besides that, drug dealers have also figured out how to benefit. Sergeant McCabe.
You have what are so-called sober homes next to houses that sell drugs. Back in the day, you never really had that.
The sheer number of opioid overdoses in South Florida is overwhelming police, firefighters, hospitals, and morgues. Officials estimate first responders in Palm Beach County answered 5,000 overdose calls last year, more than twice as many as the year before. And then there's the psychological toll.
I'm in my 32nd year. Our personnel at a very young age, young in tenure, are seeing more deaths than I've seen in my career.
Delray Beach Fire Rescue Chief Neil DeJesus brought on a stress management counselor to help his firefighters cope.
It's unlike anything we've seen. It's just not normal.
What's causing all those deaths, by and large, is the third factor. Street heroin is now cut with super potent synthetic opioids like fentanyl and carfentanil, thousands of times stronger than morphine. And the overdose reversal drug, naloxone, often referred to by the brand name Narcan, isn't working like it used to. McCabe says now the Delray Beach police usually have to wait for the fire department.
They could do it through the vein. They could do it through the bone marrow.
Bone marrow?
Yeah. They get out a little drill. Looks like a Black & Decker drill. They drill it into either your shin bone or your shoulder. And they basically little thing sticks out of it when they're done. And they just plug the Narcan through there and it goes right through it.
Through the bone marrow and straight into the bloodstream. Even that is no guarantee for revival.
2954.
I have two overdoses in progress. One is seizing. They are both breathing with gurgling respiration.
10-4-51.
We arrive at the house and McCabe parks in the yard.
Mind if we come in?
Yeah, please.
Upstairs?
Yeah. There's a needle on the floor.
In a room upstairs, two young women are overdosing on heroin. Both are unconscious, one's not breathing. She's turning blue. After about 10 minutes, the first victim comes walking out with firefighters. They strap her into a stretcher waiting outside the door. Then the other woman is carried out on a stretcher. She wasn't breathing, so firefighters got out the drill.
If you look at the girl's shoulder, remember the thing I was telling you about where they go through the bone marrow?
Yeah.
They did it to her.
You can see it, a clear plastic tube sticking out of her shoulder.
All right, so one girl took 7, the other one took 10 doses.
Doses of the overdose reversal drug.
It seems like there are more and more doses every time.
None of the 4 overdose calls Sergeant McCabe responded to this night in Delray Beach were fatal. Not so for the 10 fatal ODs in Palm Beach County in a single day last month, or the estimated 4,000 people who died from opioid overdoses in Florida last year. Governors of 5 states have declared the opioid crisis a public health emergency. Florida lawmakers have called on Governor Rick Scott to do the same.
There's another, sometimes darker side to the work of treatment and recovery, though. Corruption appears to be rampant. There's been a model for decades now where patients live in so-called sober homes while undergoing drug treatment in South Florida. It's worked well in many cases, and so the model grew, and Peter Hayden says that growth opened the door to fraud and a host of people looking to exploit recovering addicts.
The problems arise about 7 years ago when some shady treatment operators figured out they could make a lot of money by giving the patients in recovery a lot of unnecessary drug tests. And then they would nuke their insurance with charges for these tests. And this was really the revelation to criminals in the space that these vulnerable recovering addicts flooding the state could be used as cash cows. Since then, there's been a bonanza of fraud and criminality in the South Florida recovery industry. Money laundering, human trafficking, prostitution, and one of the most common charges we're seeing now is for patient brokering. This is essentially treatment centers bidding on addicts that are living in the sober houses. The sober home operator refers the patient to the treatment center. The treatment center bills the patient's insurance and then gives a nice kickback to the sober home operator. This is widely practiced in the industry, but it's illegal.
And I have to think that in many, many cases when people are bidding on addicts, that they're not counting on these addicts being one-time customers. I mean, people are really betting on failure here and repeated failure, right?
In many cases. And something even more insidious, Todd, some of these recovering users, when their insurance gets tapped out and their benefits are up, some treatment center operators have encouraged them to use drugs again so they can document their relapse, send them to detox, and then start their insurance benefits all over and bring them back in with fresh benefits.
So describe the tension here. I mean, this is $1 billion a year industry in Delray and in Palm Beach County, which means it's good for the economy. Ostensibly, there's lots of legitimate recovery going on. On the other hand, city managers and other people around there are confronting a situation, I take it from your piece, where there are hundreds, if not thousands, of outsiders who are addicts struggling to recover or on the streets, a situation that nobody who lives there wants. What's the tension here between the economic opportunity and all the other liabilities?
Well, there are certainly many good actors in the recovery space here in South Florida, and they, even probably more than anyone else, have really gotten a black eye from this criminality going on in the industry and all the bad press that it's generated and the charges. So there are a lot of people doing things the right way. As for the individual municipalities, they are really frustrated. Their hands are tied from regulating sober homes because the recovering addicts are classified as disabled under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And the Fair Housing Act, another federal statute, prevents cities from passing any ordinances to regulate them. So the cities can't really do anything to rein this in.
Where does this mess go from here? Is there any strategy to get out of it?
There are some legislative fixes that lawmakers are trying to push through to provide more oversight to this industry, to close loopholes that some of the sober homes and treatment centers are using to milk the insurance. That's going on up in Tallahassee right now, and those bills are sitting in committees. There's 2 weeks left in the legislative session, and no one is sure if they're going to get passed through or not.
It's a remarkable report that you filed. We thank you for it. Peter Hayden, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Peter Hayden is a reporter at WLRN. You're listening there to the streets in Caracas, Venezuela, where protests against the government of Nicolas Maduro are growing bigger and more violent. On Wednesday, tens of thousands of protesters took to the streets in Caracas in what opposition leaders called the mother of all marches. Since the Supreme Court's decision to effectively strip the Venezuelan Congress of power 3 weeks ago, there have been six deaths, three of which happened yesterday, despite the fact that that decision by the courts was almost immediately overturned. Joining me now from Caracas is Anatoly Kermanayev. He's a Wall Street Journal reporter in Venezuela. Anatoly, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So we've been tracking the protests around the country and the unrest amid food shortages for many, many months. Why now? Why the escalation in protests that we're seeing?
Well, what triggered this was the government sort of ill-fated decision to try to dissolve completely the opposition-controlled Congress. Since December 2015, when the opposition won its biggest ever victory in 18 years, the government has been gradually chipping away at the Congress's powers. And for some reason, President Maduro decided that even that was too much an affront to his power. And his allied judges in Supreme Court issued a ruling where it said that the Congress is now dissolved. And that was just a bit too much for most people here. That sort of triggered this pent-up anger with the economy, with food shortages, with the economic collapse, and definitely has put the opposition on the offensive. And we've been rocked by the protest almost daily here and for the last 3 weeks.
Nicolas Maduro and some of his spokesmen have blamed the unrest on CIA-backed elements within the country, basically blaming it on the United States. I mean, there is a long enough history of American meddling in Latin America and Venezuela. Certainly a lot of Venezuelans are primed to believe that it continues. Is there any evidence here that might be the case?
This is very common boogeyman for Venezuelan government. And keep in mind that the last time there was a coup against this government in 2002, the U.S. government was, if not actively involved, it was very much well aware of the planning and knew the coup was coming and condoned it. This time around, there isn't much evidence of U.S. involvement at all, really. First of all, they seem to learn their lesson of 2002. And second, it's just a feeling that you don't need, you know, when the country is so dysfunctional, so badly run, you don't really need, you know, some deep conspirational sort of actions here in order to achieve your goal. You know, the government is crumbling at the seams through its own actions, through its own inefficiency and capacity to run the economy, basically. So it's all pretty much homemade here in terms of a crisis.
So you're expecting protests to continue today, of course. What is the proximal goal here, Anatoly? What could happen? What concessions could be made, if there were any, by Nicolas Maduro and his government to get people to put down their sticks and rocks and give it another try here?
The opposition's goal is to force the government to negotiate, basically, to try to keep enough pressure on the government, to force enough dissent within the government, trigger enough international pressure that Maduro has to sit down and come up with a credible electoral agenda. There's presidential elections scheduled for next year. Maduro has made signs that he's not really interested in holding any elections. He's postponed pretty much every contest that was due in the country last year, from state governors down to student unions. And the idea is, if the opposition just stays in the string long enough, just, you know, throws enough rocks and sticks, eventually Maduro will have to sit down and compromise. There are some signs that he's beginning to offer concessions. He already promised elections for state governors. He's now calling again the opposition to sit down for dialogue. So it's a credible strategy, but, you know, the opposition has also run out of time, because people, they are tired, they're exhausted, they're scared of growing repression. It's not going to be that easy to just keep them on the streets day in, day out, and maintain the momentum.
Massive protests in Venezuela and on the streets of Caracas. Anatoly Kermanayev is there with the Wall Street Journal. Anatoly, thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
Do it live! Fox News host Bill O'Reilly faces questions this morning after new details emerge about harassment allegations.
A New York Times report alleged that Fox News, and in some cases, its star anchor Bill O'Reilly, paid a total of $13 million.
Five women received a total of $13 million in payouts.
Over a dozen years to settle accusations that O'Reilly harassed five former female employees.
A new accuser today, a woman of color, who said that he had a nickname for her.
He called her hot chocolate.
Bill O'Reilly, who hosted this program for 20 years, is leaving the Fox News Channel.
Well, that's how the news business, and even Fox News itself, handled the story yesterday that Bill O'Reilly has been removed from the show that bore his name for 20 years. The O'Reilly Factor was the number one rated show on cable news and made its parent company, 21st Century Fox, and its founder, Rupert Murdoch, millions of dollars. Some of O'Reilly's alleged behavior toward women he worked with was well known and didn't seem to faze O'Reilly's employer for many years. But a New York Times investigation into sexual harassment allegations, quietly settled over the years by O'Reilly and his employer, changed things. Dozens of advertisers pulled their money out of the O'Reilly Factor. And like they did with former Fox News CEO Roger Ailes, the parent company opened an investigation of its own into O'Reilly's behavior. Bob Garfield is with me. He's a longtime journalist. He's co-host of On the Media from WNYC. Bob, welcome.
Thank you, Todd.
It's great to have you here. We went over a couple of the allegations against O'Reilly. Can we just do a quick inventory? Why were the latest investigations from the New York Times dispositive here? Some of these allegations against O'Reilly from women were known for years. Why did it matter now?
Well, it mattered now because the New York Times spread it all over page one. It's very easy to dismiss allegations, as O'Reilly did actually for years, as politically motivated, as motivated by money or just attention, except that this time the Times took the due diligence to actually have the goods. And O'Reilly went down protesting, but ultimately he became too much of a risk for 21st Century Fox. That is a huge cash cow for not just Fox News Channel, but for the overall corporation. They just could not afford to keep plugging leaks.
There are reports of more allegations from more women to come, reporting that came out of Rupert Murdoch's meetings with talent at Fox News, also ongoing allegations of racial discrimination. This seems like a liability that the corporation, the parent company, is viewing here as potentially open-ended, and that's something that no CEO wants to see.
No, and not only this business is riding on it, but 21st Century Fox has interests elsewhere, including its seemingly never-ending quest to own Sky, all of Sky TV, and that was blocked by regulators in the UK because of misbehavior by Fox and its failure to prove that it's a good corporate citizen. So they needed to write this problem off in order to have any kind of clear-eyed view of its future.
But Bob, the ink is barely dry on Roger Ailes' resignation and ouster for similar reasons, for behavior that was swept under the rug or actively suppressed by Fox News for many, many years. This seems to be of a piece of settling lawsuits and sort of being okay with them until the messaging and the news media reporting on those allegations becomes untenable and makes it too difficult to generate revenue.
That is true, and that's the way corporations settle lawsuits. They quietly pay money and hope that the thing is buried. In this case, there's an investigation going on as to whether anything criminal occurred, which is whether shareholders paid hush money to women without knowing it was happening. And that's what the Justice Department is investigating in the New York District. But if you'll permit me, Todd, to commandeer this conversation, I don't think the history of sexual harassment litigation is the real story here. The real story here is that Humpty Dumpty, Bill O'Reilly, has fallen. And it was the brightest star, I guess, just ahead of Rush Limbaugh in the great right-wing conspiracy. And it was this man that softened the ground, and I would say hardened the resentment of millions and millions of people to create the conditions that have led to Trumpism and the Trump presidency today. The significance that he played in the culture wars cannot be overstated. He lost his job, but he and Roger Ailes won the culture wars, and that's why this society is in the predicament it's in.
And I'm glad you went there because I wanted to ask you exactly about Bill O'Reilly's role at Fox News, a show, The O'Reilly Factor, that waved the flag of aging white grievance in a demographically diverse society, a changing society. That grievance is a profit engine. Can it chug the way it did going into the future without O'Reilly, that brand of white grievance that he made so profitable and popular?
Can the outrage industry continue as it has in the past? Yeah, sure it can. He was their biggest star. He was not their only star. They still have Sean Hannity, who is nothing more than a propagandist for a certain right-wing worldview. And they have Fox and Friends, which is the morning show, which was trading in alternate facts and alternate reality long before Kellyanne Conway ever uttered that phrase. They have some players, and Tucker Carlson is no newbie. I mean, he's been in this game with a lower profile, but nonetheless, he's been in the white grievance game for 10 or 15 years himself, so it may even be more. So he's taking over for O'Reilly, and while the style has changed, the bellicosity, the kind of bullying that made O'Reilly famous or infamous, I don't think that is replaceable. But, to answer your basic question, yeah, it'll keep chugging along. There is a huge marketplace of grievance, and it will be well catered to. And if you're to believe my go-to media pundit, Allison Bickford, who is my daughter, we haven't seen the last of O'Reilly. She predicts, and I don't think she's nuts, that he will reemerge pretty soon, possibly on some Breitbart TV network, which has been discussed for some time. So, I don't think we've seen the last of this dude either.
Bob Garfield says that the grievance industry will continue to chug without one of its chief engineers, Bill O'Reilly. Bob Garfield, longtime journalist, host of On the Media at WNYC. Bob, thanks.
My pleasure, Todd.
Hi, this is Jim from Northern Mass. The way I see it, as long as products like tobacco and alcohol are legal, then cannabis should be as well. People ought to be able to pick their own poison so long as they're not dangerous.
Hi, this is Bee from the Dallas area. I do believe that cannabis has useful medical applications, but also that its abuse can destroy one's potential for healthy and productive life. However, so does alcohol.
This is Dee Dee from San Francisco. And just like alcohol during Prohibition, unless it's legalized for both recreational and medical reasons, we'll have an underground criminal market. Right now, I think the federal government should just let the states decide for themselves.
Hi, my name is Catherine Garcia. I'm calling from Seattle, Washington. As a Washington resident, I'm in favor of the legal medical and recreational use of cannabis. I believe cannabis offers many medical benefits for patients who cannot tolerate big pharma drugs.
Lots of your thoughts there because we put the call out to you. It's World Cannabis Day, and it's a holiday that may have passed without a lot of serious notice in the past, but now things are a bit different for marijuana and our relationship to it, and you can hear it in your voices there. More than half of the states in the country now have legalized marijuana, mostly for medical use, but 8 states and the District of Columbia have legalized cannabis for recreational use. In Canada, meanwhile, they're moving to legalize cannabis nationally, and all the legalization seems to be making some of the stigma around marijuana fall away. But the Trump administration, or at least key parts of it, aren't interested in flowing with this tide. The Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, has for years made his anti-pot positions known, and now he has the power to make a difference in that fight.
I, as you know, am dubious about marijuana. States, can pass whatever laws they choose, but I'm not sure we're going to be a better, healthier nation if we have marijuana being sold at every corner grocery store.
Now, that was the Attorney General Jeff Sessions back in February speaking to the National Association of Attorneys General at their winter meeting. Ricardo Baca is here. He's founder of The Cannabist. He's also a marijuana columnist for The Daily Beast. Ricardo, welcome.
Hey, thanks so much.
Let's take this moment to take an inventory here. We mentioned all of the states and jurisdictions where marijuana is now legal. What's the size of the legal industry now? How big is this thing?
You know, it's growing. And, you know, marijuana initiatives went 8-for-9 at the ballot box in November. You know, yet another sign of this, how robust this industry and how strongly it's going to be moving forward in the years to come.
Do we have a good national dollar figure on how big this is?
You know, right now, I don't have it off the top of my head, but I can tell you in the third year of sales just here in Colorado alone, we're a medium-sized state out here in the West, and we sold $1.3 billion of cannabis just in Colorado. That's more than $150 million in tax revenues. And, you know, just imagine when you extrapolate those figures to a market like California, it's going to be substantial. Of course, it's going to be legendary. It's worth noting that, you know, in the course of Colorado's annual budget, operating budget, which is around $27 billion, marijuana tax revenues are kind of a drop in the bucket. That's what legislators say, but it's still revenues that didn't exist before. And also, these sales didn't exist before either. They were happening on the black market, if they were happening at all. So largely, this is looked at as a success, something that can be done responsibly.
Let's talk about downsides, potential downsides. It is a drug. Addiction is a factor, even if marijuana itself is not physically addicting. Intoxication, operating motor vehicles, even just an increase in overall use. What data are there on potential malign effects of the implementation of legalization?
You know, it's true. This is a substance that is 9% addictive. It's considered 9% addictive. 9% of the people who come into contact with it can feel addictive qualities, but that pales in comparison to other recreational substances, including alcohol, nicotine, prescription drugs, illegal drugs. And so when we approached this experiment, especially out here in the West, you know, we were the first state, the first locality in the world to really implement these measures in the modern world. This has not happened before, especially in a regulated fashion. So, you know, there were a lot of hypotheticals out there. What about the kids? What if this makes our roads unsafe? And all of those are really valid questions. But what we've seen in the early years, again, we're only 3.5 years into these early sales, but we've seen that the marijuana-based DUIs are actually going down. There was a story in the Denver Post out here just this week saying year over year, the first quarter of marijuana-based DUIs were down more than a third.
I do want to make sure that we get to the Attorney General. Sorry to cut you off there, Ricardo, but we have about a minute and a half, and I think this is real important because
sure.
We do have a new Attorney General in office who has made his views very clear on marijuana. I mean, this is a state issue. He can't completely stop the trend, right? What power can he use? What can he do at the federal level to make this legalization trend and this liberalization trend slow down?
You know, what it comes down to is Jeff Sessions would like to stop marijuana. Could he if he wanted to? He definitely could. I mean, it's within his purview to try and do this. Does it behoove him? You know, it's a fact that Jeff Sessions is largely wrong on most issues of cannabis and legalization. I mean, he's very behind the times. I just wrote a lead editorial on this for the Denver Post last week. And, you know, his outlook on this is a very 1960s, 1970s drug war friendly outlook. And we've just moved beyond that. So
that's fair enough. But can he can't change the law in Colorado, but can he make things more difficult?
He definitely can, and we've already seen a very serious chilling effect, especially in terms of investment in the industry. A lot of big money players aren't necessarily willing to get into it right now just because of the unknown.
And that's potentially important. Predictability in a growing industry is important no matter what that industry is. And it is possible from the federal level that if there's going to be a federal crackdown from the Department of Justice, that predictability could sour. Ricardo Baca, founder of The Cannabist, columnist at The Daily Beast, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And on this World Cannabis Day, we've been hearing lots of your thoughts about legalizing marijuana and some of your concerns as well.
Hello, this is Kate Kevern from Eugene, Oregon. I'm concerned about lung health. Cannabis supporters say it is perfectly healthy, but are we creating a new generation of lung disease sufferers?
Hi, this is Leah calling from New York. It should be legal entirely. Scientifically and statistically, it makes no sense that recreational cannabis is illegal while alcohol is legal. And the federal government should decriminalize it at every level and let the states control the taxes.
Hi, my name is Misha, and I'm calling from Woodridge, Illinois. I believe marijuana use should be completely legal with the same age requirements of alcohol. With all the historical and statistical data on marijuana, it makes reasonable sense for it to be legal. Jeff Sessions is totally behind the curve when it comes to his opinion on this matter. Thanks.
Let us know what you think about changing marijuana laws across the country and a potential crackdown from Washington. 8778-MY-TAKE is the number. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, working to help people reclaim between 5 and 30 minutes a day to learn something new and build their CQ or Curious Quotient through the game of lifelong learning. More at Curious.com/PRI. Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. You can also check out the latest John Hockenberry blog post and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org. The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering copy and print solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen. LegalZoom.com, helping small business owners get started with incorporation, LLCs, DBAs, and nonprofits, while providing ongoing legal advice through its network of independent attorneys. More information available at LegalZoom.com/takeaway. Curious.com, working to help people reclaim between 5 and 30 minutes a day to learn something new and build their CQ or Curious Quotient through the game of lifelong learning. More at Curious.com/PRI. And Moo, working to help businesses of any size create customized business cards, postcards, stickers, and more. Learn more at Moo.com.